Digital Path, the podcast where we talk to people from the world of audio about their ideas, opinions, and methods.
Hello, I'm Andrew Anderson. Today on the podcast, we have Mikey Young, alternative music's ultimate multitasker. First a guitarist with Australian garage legends Eddie Current Suppression Ring, then later with post-punk outfit Total Control, he's made a second career for himself mixing and mastering records. I caught up with Mikey to find out a bit more about how he transitioned from stage to studio, his approach to mixing and mastering, and how he overcame his addiction to vintage gear. Mikey Young is next. How's life in Australia right now?
I haven't got quiet at all, and I'm pretty used to like not leaving the house much. Like I don't, you know, I get out of bed, I have a coffee, I go into the studio, I work till like six, I make dinner. So 6 days out of seven, I'm probably just home kicking around anyway. So it hasn't changed my life too much. And strangely, I got busier. Like people are sending me more records to work on.
I want to kind of go back to the start of when you first began making music and recording it. You were working at a record pressing plant.
For a bit more context, even before that, in like 1999, when I first moved out of the suburbs to the city, I bought a four track, like I think it was the first digital four track, like a Fostex, and I bought a one microphone, like a 57, and an Alesis compressor and a Yamaha DJX keyboard, and just started making music by myself, like just really poor man's kind of like trip hop. And then I had a buddy that was a DJ, and he heard some of my demos and played it to this label that called Modular. It was kind of a big-ish indie label over here at the time. And they kind of like signed me for some reason. They gave me some money to, buy stuff and develop my craft. And so it was like $17,500. I didn't own anything then. So I bought like a Mac and Pro Tools and a Wurlitzer and a synth, and then kind of just taught myself a little bit about recording. I guess, yeah, fast forward a few years, I'd got my job at Gilderoy, the pressing plant. When I was at the pressing plant, Nick, the boss, he turned up to work with an Atari 5058 track and a big old British mixing desk at Chilton. And he was like, "You know how to record bands, don't you, Mikey?" And I was like, "Nah." He was like, "Yeah, you do." And he was like, "I've got this band coming down for Brisbane this week. You're going to record them." I was like, "Oh, shit." And so I kind of had to make it up like that weekend and record this band, the Herkawis. And I had one SM-48 on the drum kit, like not even facing the drummer. Like I just didn't know what I was doing at all. And it was definitely trial and error. And a lot of times, like the next day, like the day after we recorded the first Eddie Current album, I had my first paid job, probably. Like a friend's band was like, "Oh, we want to record." Like it was like, "Oh, well, I've got all the stuff set up. Why don't you just come in the next day?" And I recorded that. And I think word just got around, because I guess when was this? Like 2005. Even though it doesn't seem that long ago, like people recording themselves was not a common thing then. Like most bands in Melbourne were still going to studios in the early 2000s. And I think word just got around, like, there's this dude that's got like an 8-track and he'll go around and record your band. So like I just became like the default person. But I definitely just learnt on the job. And sometimes I wish that I actually learnt a bit more professional, you know, like actually got some kind of lessons or insight in how to do these things, because there's a lot of mistakes I kept making for years just because I didn't know any better, you know.
Oh, could you give me an example of some of those things?
Yeah, I'd say mainly just drum sounds, because like you can put a mic in front of a guitar and if your amp sounds okay, it's probably going to sound okay. So I know that's not quite true, but it's relatively true compared to a drum kit, I think. even just things like, oh, if I flip the phase of one of the mics, it might make the whole kit sound better, you know, like I didn't really understand about that. Sometimes I'm just amazed how long it took me to learn simple things like that that I probably just should have known if I like went to school or something. I mean, it's nice that I've developed my own way of doing things, I'm sure, in some way, but sometimes I just feel like an idiot.
Did you ever watch anyone else or like have any like sit in on anyone else's sessions to pick up any tips?
It was entirely working it out. My main driving force was like there was these bunch of great bands in Melbourne in like the early 2000s when I first started going to gigs and stuff, and I'd go see them and I'd buy their CD and it just didn't sound right. I was like, oh, why can't bands just sound like bands, you know, like sure you can just make people play and then you put mics in front of it and it sounds like that. So I think that's all I wanted out of recordings when I started recording, was just to try and replicate that idea.
Well, let's talk about that approach. How is it you go about getting that?
I mean, it depends on the type of band too, you know. If it's a garage band, like maybe I'll intentionally go out of my way to not fix, you know, leaks too much and, you know, not separate everyone too much. And sometimes with like a more raucous band, it's nice to have the singer singing live and like the vocal mic almost becomes a room mic when they're not singing. Sometimes it can be really hard to make vocals sit in a mix that and make them sound like they were with the band, you know.
What you lose in control, you kind of gain in vibe.
You lose control of like cymbals bleeding into the vocal mic and like some kind of phasey issues and stuff like that, but like especially with a band like Eddie Curran, I there's no way I'd do it any other way because Brendan just doesn't perform as well if he's not singing with us, you know, and running around the room like he is live, you know, like so I'd rather just deal with like the mic, you know, the volume kind of fluctuations and everything, just because the performance, I get, you know, if there is a philosophy, I guess that's it. Whatever makes the band perform in a relaxed way like they would like at practice or something is way more important than any kind of fidelity issues to me.
Okay. How did you kind of transition into this like record guru kind of guy?
Well, basically I was forced into it a little, kind of like how the recording thing happened. It was like, yeah, you can do this. When I was doing the first UV Race album, like I'd recorded it and mixed it. I was like, who do you want to master? And they're like, oh, you can master it. I was like, oh, I've never mastered a record before. I can't, I'm not a mastering engineer. And they're like, yeah, you can. And I think people, my friends especially, just assumed that because I worked at a pressing plant, like I had some like secret knowledge about what should and shouldn't happen with a master. So I was like, all right, mate, if you want me to do it. So I did it. And the record turned out fine. Then the second one was Scott and Charlene's Wedding, like their first record. Like I didn't know Craig at the time. And he emailed me and said, oh, can you master our record? I heard you master records. And I was like, oh, man, I got to tell you, I'm not a mastering engineer at all. You know, I just did that UV Race album because they're my friends. And he said the same thing. He was like, oh, no, it'll be right. And so I did that one and that turned out okay too. And then it just kind of like flowed on from there. And gradually I got better at it, like, and wasn't, you know, it took me not so much now, but it took me years and years. Like, I guess all that's like over 10 years ago now. And it took me a long time before I just didn't feel like a total sham, you know, like I was just making it up and like, someone's going to catch me out. And I think actually there was a stage about 3 or 4 years in, I was like, oh, I'm getting pretty busy. Maybe I should try and it was probably about 3 years in. And I remember writing to like Chicago mastering because I was going to be in America for a bit on tour. And I was like, you know, would you guys ever like have an intern that just kind of sat around and asked questions? But, and they were like, yeah, sure, do it. But they said something that really comforted me at the time. It was just, I think it was Jason there, and he was just, he just said, you know, you're welcome to come here, but, like, you know, we feel the same, man. Like, like that's how we felt when we started, and you know, that we were just kind of, we didn't know what we were doing either. And it just made me think, oh, maybe everyone feels like that. Like, and I was like, I was busy at the time, like work was coming in. I was like, oh, maybe it's best to actually just keep working rather than take time off work to learn how to work. And so I just came back from tour and kept at it. And the mixing side of things was I just got sick of recording. I'm not really that of all the processes, like sitting, unless the band I love or the band's my friends, like, you know, and I didn't have a studio, so I'd always have to cart stuff around to like some like abandoned warehouse or a holiday house or something, which can be fun, but it also can be a drag. Like, anyway, like the idea of sitting in a room for like 4 days with some people I don't really know that well and some tunes I don't really care about just didn't seem like the least enjoyable thing of the whole three processes. I enjoy mixing records of bands that I don't necessarily love. I enjoy mastering everything, but like recording I find a bit of a drag unless I kind of love it. It's also the part of the process that I felt I was the least good at. So I was like, well, if something's going to go, I should get rid of that.
You know, how many records are you mastering in a given week or month, and the same with mixing?
Oh, man, it's crazy. If I'm mastering an album, I won't do more than one a day. But, you know, then there'll be like, you know, tracks, like individual tracks and EPs and stuff like that. But most days I'll at least master an album. And if I've got any spare time, I'll keep mixing. Learning, you know, like if there's a couple of hours left at the end of the day, I'll do some revisions of a record I'm mixing. Or some days I'll spend a whole day mixing and not master. But right now I'm mixing about 6 or 7 albums in various stages of completion. And probably, you know, last week I would have mastered probably 5 albums.
That thing you talked about earlier, that transition of now bands do record themselves. So I suppose more and more people are like, kind of like, well, we've done this, but we need someone to actually, you know, polish it and organize it.
If bands have no budget, like there's, you know, you can get free computer mastering these days and stuff like that. But like mixing seems like a bit of a stumbling block for a lot of bands. Like I think I get a lot of projects of bands that have probably recorded themselves in Logic or something and then kind of tried to mix it and hit a bit of a brick wall. Yeah, I think I get a lot of work from that end where like just people haven't got the kind of monitoring or like, you know, just skills or whatever to mix their own record, and hopefully I can kind of make it better.
You know, some people kind of have the view that the record shouldn't be mastered by the same person that mixes it. What's your take on that?
I don't think anything should ever be a rule, but if every band had the budget, I'd say go ahead and get 2 separate people, because yeah definitely I don't always have the, you know, complete objectivity to master a record after I've spent a long time mixing it. So, like, if someone has the money, like, I'd probably prefer it. But it's just, you know, it's just a fact that a lot of, like, local bands and stuff don't have the budget. Before I was doing this here, like, mastering for, like, you know, not for kind of cheap, there wasn't that many cheap options. It was, like, pay $1,000 to master your record, you know, and as kind of garage band culture kicked in and more people started recording themselves, it just seemed kind of ludicrous to spend, oh, we just spent $300 recording an album and now we're going to spend $1,000 mastering it. That's kind of insanity. It just fell to me because I could do both cheaply.
Yeah, let's talk about mastering a bit more. So often it's like described as you know, more of a dark art than a science.
Yeah, I don't subscribe to that dark art kind of nonsense at all. I think it's only considered that because a lot of people just don't know what it is. Like, it's not that it's hard, it's just they haven't been explained to what is happening. And, you know, if it's far less a dark art than recording or mixing, you know, I sometimes hate it that I get like this kind of kudos in like press sometimes for like mastering a record, like I've put my stamp on it, when and like the person that's mixed it or recorded it has barely got a mention, you know, and it's so much, all that stuff is so much more integral to like the overall sound of something, you know. So often I think mastering's got a little, you know, a little more weights put on it than is necessary. I've just got a small studio at home. Like, it's nothing flash, but, you know, I've made the most out of a difficult space with, like, you know, sort of a lot of kind of bass traps and acoustic treatment. I've got a fairly limited amount of outboard gear. I've got this weird valve EQ compressor combo thing by this Australian brand Sebatron that's been around for a while, but this is an early thing he made that he never made. I don't know if he ever made another one. I ran into him and he said he lost the design and wanted to buy this one back, but I don't want to sell it to him. I've got an Atari 5050 tape machine that I occasionally run things to tape if someone really wants it, but honestly I don't always use all this stuff. Like, I'm just as happy to be in the box if I don't think going out to any of this stuff is going to have any benefit. I reckon that's the main thing that's changed for me over the, you know, this 20-year course or whatever, like, is that my kind of obsession for like retro stuff or looking backwards has kind of died. Like, well, I've got to have this tape machine, I've got to have this drum machine, and now that a lot of digital stuff is so good, like, I kind of just want to look forward and embrace like plugins that do weird things that I couldn't do with other, you know, and I also want, be it mixing someone else's job or working on my own music, I kind of want the system that allows me to get from A to B as kind of efficiently as possible. And like sometimes with like old synths and MIDI cables and DIN boxes and stuff like that, you know, you spend half your time like getting set up to make this, to put this idea down, you know, when you could have just like had it down in, you know, half the time. I know it's a boring answer, but like if you're going into mixing more, it's far more advantageous to like save your money and put it towards like better monitors or even like room treatment, and like so you can actually hear what you're doing rather than, you know, because the difference between like some cool old compressor and some kind of emulation is just it's not that great anymore, I don't think.
Okay, well, what plugins are you using in the box then? What stuff do you use in that environment?
I seem to gravitate to all the Tokyo Dawn stuff on pretty much every session, just their mastering EQ and their compressor and their limiter. I use that Soothe 2 plugin a lot as basically a de-esser kind of thing. The less I can mess around with stuff, the better, probably. I guess the other one that feels pretty indispensable is like that Pro DSM plugin, Dynamic Spectral Mapper or whatever it's called, like as just a really heavy de-esser. Because, you know, I guess that's the main problem with a lot of home recordings is like the monitoring for like the lows and the highs is usually pretty wacky, so like sometimes you just get super bright stuff or you get super bassy stuff, so like finding tools that can just hammer down, you know, relatively invisibly on the lows and the highs is a godsend. And a lot of the a lot of the digital tools that do that just, you know, aren't available in the analog world, you know. There's there's just some stuff that I couldn't replicate with hardware, I don't think.
Let's say some band was planning on recording their own thing, sending it to you, you know, to make, what's kind of the most basic advice you would give someone on, you know, kind of, you know, a few things to avoid doing or to at that stage in order to make things simpler for when someone like yourself is mixing the record remotely?
Really clean sessions where like bits of the things you don't want, like heaps of chatter and like, you know, guitar twiddling and stuff are like cut out, helps a lot. You know, I guess when I've got to go in and heavily edit a lot of crap out that's not meant to be there in a session is just kind of a waste of time and money. So like if a band can do all that stuff first and send me kind of clean stems, that helps a lot. That's pretty much it. You know, so if someone's recorded in Logic or GarageBand and they kind of have a basic idea of, even if it's just the panning and stuff, that can help a lot. It kind of like, yeah, it's like being handed a rough mix and it's just a nice kind of launching pad.
That was Mikey Young, and this has been Signal Path. If you enjoyed this episode, then please subscribe to the podcast to get more great stories and insights from the people shaping the world of audio. Thanks for listening. Hope you join us again soon.